Spirit Radio Podcasts.
British Prime Minister Theresa May has been a very busy lady this week with negotiations in Brussels, press conferences and speeches in the House of Commons. Well, she won't be getting the weekend off either, and I suspect she probably hasn't had one off for quite a long time because she has further meetings in Brussels tomorrow, followed by an EU leaders' summit on Sunday. Yesterday, she declared that a deal was within our grasp as she held a 26-page declaration on the UK's post-Brexit relationship with the European Union. But there was an immediate criticism of the declaration from the likes of Jeremy Corbyn, who called it 26 pages of waffle, and departed Cabinet Ministers Dominic Raab and Boris Johnson, who said it makes a complete nonsense of Brexit. But does it really? On the line to tell us more of our regular political commentator, Susan Phillips. Good morning to you, Susan.
Good morning, Wendy.
Well, before we get on to what the politicians and ex-politicians are saying about this the latest on Brexit, what do we know about just what ordinary people on the ground in the UK are feeling on it all?
Well, it's interesting you should ask me that, because I've just been in London for 2 days, and, you know, the way I operate, I talk to an awful lot of people at every level and every interest area. And all I can say, Wendy, is there's absolutely nothing unanimous amongst anybody. Those that want to go have different reasons for going. Those that want to stay are arguing with the deal not being right as to what they want for trade. I've never seen so many ordinary thinkers so absolutely divided. And if you look at the papers, for example, Travelling on the Underground, there seems to be free magazine called the Metro Papers. Obviously, I picked it up and read it. And big picture on the front was a whole lot of the MP male Brexiters all lined up, and a big sign saying their dad's army. And then you go and look at the headlines of the Telegraph, which is very Brexit, and they're criticising Mrs. May. You just couldn't get a grip on it. The only thing that did stun a lot of Brexiteers was that they could not get 48 signatories to remove Mrs. May. It wouldn't have removed her, but to have a debate.
I think for a lot of people, in terms of just trying to actually break down and understand all the documents that are out there, the discussions that are being had, it's quite difficult. And obviously here in Ireland, one of the things that we're most concerned about is the backstop. But even the wording for that is difficult to get your head around.
It is, and I'll come to that. But just to bring you up to date, Mrs. May, who has got universal support for her being absolutely doggedly, determinedly, just there with the force of, I don't know how she's done it, but people do admire her. They may not like what she's doing, but she goes back to Brussels either today and tomorrow for last-minute talks, because it's Sunday when all the EU ministers meet, and it's hoped that at last everything could be signed off on, and they're saying that, future ties are ready to be rubber stamped by the Prime Minister, Theresa May, and all the 27 leaders. So that's Sunday. And so that's both the legal divorce treaty and the accompanying political declaration on the two sides, how they'll negotiate future trading. So it's really going to be a big day Sunday. And of course, even if it goes through the 27, and there's obviously a little bit of a problem with Spain and Gibraltar, it then has to go through the House of Commons. And if it doesn't succeed in getting through the British parliamentary system, then what happens? Does Britain enter a period of uncertainty? Because there's only, we've only got until March, and then does Britain crash out? It's very complicated, because the deal, which they're going to sort of check out on Sunday if they can cover it, has some last-minute changes. For example, Gibraltar, because Spain has asked for changes in the document to be absolutely sure that any future decisions about the Gibraltar and Spanish relationship will only be taken in direct talks with Madrid. So there's all of that. The actual deal covers, we know that, the financial settlement, the expatriates' rights, but above all, as you've just mentioned, the sensitive Irish border. And I'll try and explain it to you, Wendy, but I've only actually just completely got it myself. So I'll try and explain it to listeners. So the backstop is, obviously, it's at the heart of the differing views. In the original plan, it was a plan to keep a frictionless border between north and south of Ireland, so that we could never go back to terrorists being at a hard customs post. And, in other words, the Good Friday Agreement had to be kept, and the island had to be seen as one. But the only way that that could happen with this deal was that the EU suggested, and people agreed that if the North could be made slightly special with some customs union regulations, then they wouldn't need a border, and the border was obviously called the backstop. But and that wasn't acceptable to everybody, but the latest draft wording, which is going to come up on Sunday, keeps using the word technology more than backstop. But you see, the point is that...
So what will that actually mean?
What does it mean? And the DUP is still opposing the new draft. It says that the new wording, it can use the word technology more than backstop, but that could see extra checks on goods coming between Northern Ireland and Great Britain, and could create a division between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. In other words, would this or would this not mean that Northern Ireland is slightly separated from the UK? That's the, you know, how do you not separate them if you don't have a border? And that is the new wording. So they're using the word technology much more than they use the word backstop.
Do you think there'll be much light shed on that at the discussions this Sunday, Susan?
Well, I think that, well, Angela Merkel, for one, and she has to be there, she says, I'm not going there on Sunday to chat and negotiate. You have to have said that by Saturday night you've sorted out last-minute wording. But it isn't as simple as that because, for example, there's a DUP conference. I think it's tomorrow. Yes, it's Saturday. And the DUP have got to address how will we, the DUP, vote in the Commons when it comes, if it's signed off on Sunday, what side are we going to vote on? And they're absolutely aware and they're very angry that in the North, farmers and industrialists are actually saying, let's keep this deal. It's not brilliant, but it's an awful lot better than a crash out. So what does Arlene Foster do? And then into the bargain, the Ulster unionists, who always sort of were Remain. You don't forget the majority of Northern Irish people were Remain. But the Ulster unionists have also said that they see this new wording as a threat to the union. So, and then you've got the Tory Brexiters endorsing the DUP. And you know that the DUP at the moment are holding up Theresa May's government. So what's going to happen?
That's the thing. Will it all hold together?
Well, I'm sticking my neck out, and I often do. I actually think this vote will go through Parliament in Britain. I really do. It won't happen probably for 2 to 3 weeks. There'll be roaring and shouting. But you've got to remember that some of the Labour MPs, despite Jeremy Corbyn saying that the whole deal is absolutely ridiculous, the fact is he's got people who Labour constituents who voted to remain. And I think that there'll be some Labour Party MPs who will actually back Theresa May's plan because they'll say, well, if we go back to our constituents and we say, well, we opposed it and there's a fallout and in March everything is an absolute cliff edge and we've nothing, what are the constituents going to say at the next election? So in fact, what I'm really trying to say is that all the parties, all the people in Britain are absolutely divided on this. And that's why I think in the end, and I really think it will happen, I think it will go through.
Finally, to ask you, Susan, on the Irish side of things, what are the discussions do you think that the Taoiseach will be having with all the kind of negotiations that have been going on? What are the things that the Irish government should be focusing on and concerned about?
Well, it's very interesting because, as you know, this week the Dáil passed a motion on this draft. I mean, it is only a draft till Sunday, but they passed a motion and Simon Coveney, Tonish, actually said, I am supporting this draft deal because he said, I want to send a strong signal that Ireland is behind the deal. I mean, I think that was a very politically sound move because for Ireland, let's be honest, it's a good deal. Now, Sinn Féin Mary Lou said that she wanted an amendment which said that the citizens of the North would continue to enjoy rights as EU citizens. And in fact, I think the Taoiseach said, no, let's leave that for another day. And Fianna Fáil leader, you know, Micheál Martin, he said his party supported this motion. So, you know, there were a few little amendments which he said he would have changed. But the fact of everything is that the border situation has been the one complexity.
Well, I think we've lost the line there with Susan. So that was our political commentator, Susan Phillips, there giving us her thoughts on the latest in Brexit negotiations. So my next guest joined fellow TDs in submitting amendments to the government on their abortion bill that's currently before the Dáil. Now, the amendments put forward were to try and ensure some respect was shown to unborn babies or to babies who are just about to have their lives ended. Alongside this, he has concerns about the fact that abortion, just the information surrounding it, if a woman is seeking an abortion, what information will she be given about the procedure or the tablet she's going to take, the impacts, is there going to be any counselling provided, and of course there's been very little discussion, a lot of discussion about taxpayers funding the abortion procedure, but very little discussion on funding for alternative supports for women. On the line to give us his thoughts about the process to date, we have independent TD for Tipperary, Matty McGrath. Morning, Matty. How are you?
Good morning, Wendy.
Well, let's start off with just some of the amendments that you and your fellow TDs put forward. What were they and how were they received?
Well, first instance, can I say that I'm a Democrat and I do respect the outcome of the referendum, albeit, you know, many pushes and sways in the media and whatever else, but nonetheless, the people voted. We have to assume that they voted in clear knowledge of what they were voting for. And they put the onus on the Oireachtas members to bring out legislation. Remember, the people just removed the amendment. They didn't provide for the information. So we've been very careful and very conscious in the pro-life TDs and pro-life people not to try and, you know, be any way dampen this or to delay the bill. So we put in 16 amendments out of a total of 186. Less than 10% of the amendments. So for people to say that we're delaying or we're prevaricating or whatever, it's totally just untrue and it doesn't bear any credence. Just to compare this abortion legislation to the finance bill yesterday, mm-hmm. I don't know, ringing me last night to know why I resubmitted amendments for the report stage in the Dáil. Yesterday in the evening, we voted on the finance bill, it passed through, but most of the amendments that we dealt with yesterday were at committee stage, discussed and debated, and some rejected by the minister, most of them, but they were put forward again to be debated by the full Dáil and be voted on there if people wanted to call a vote. So that is a normal process. So this legislation is not getting anything other than the normal process. However, what it is getting, this legislation, is we have a system now, and it's been evaluated and found to be very, very good, of a pre-legislative scrutiny. But Minister Harris decided in this rush to waive and to ask us, the business committee, I'm a member of it, objected to waive pre-legislative scrutiny, which the committee agreed, which is a bad process because it examines legislation before it goes into the floor of the chamber, before it goes to the committee. And, you know, many times there are pitfalls are found there and legislation is better and stronger and more robust as a result of that.
Why then? Why is that happening? Why?
Because of his petulant attitude, his gung-ho approach because of the vote he thinks he can walk on water, and he thinks he can bulldoze this through at the fastest time. He also tried to ask the town caller to change standing orders to allow it to be debated ahead of time. There's a normal waiting process from the time amendments are submitted to the time that you can debate them. He wanted that shortened as well. And even yesterday, our business meeting, they were in a mad rush to get it passed next week. So rush legislation has often been bad legislation. Just you asked him that question. Ask the media who aren't asking the questions, who aren't challenging. If this was something else, if this was to do with greyhound racing, if this was to do with, you know, social welfare issues, social welfare bill is coming in next week, it wouldn't be tolerated.
And I've watched, indeed, and I encourage people to watch some of the discussions. You can watch them on Oireachtas.ie. And
yes,
I have to say, the attitude from the health minister I found quite shocking, just in terms of a kind of, I suppose, smug attitude in terms of some of the discussions that were had. Is it fair to say, Matty, in terms of some of the amendments you put forward, and you mentioned at the outset, look, this isn't about disrespecting the democratic result, but
no,
a lot of the amendments you put forward, I would imagine that whether somebody voted to remove or retain the Eighth Amendment, many people would agree with the amendments you put forward, whatever their position on abortion is, because they're just humane in many ways.
Of course, and it's a holy terror to have a minister that's so petulant, so inexperienced, so juvenile in his attitude, that he, as I said, the finance bill is going on at the moment, the social welfare bill next week, the finance bill finished last night, sorry. And it's standard practice since Dáil was the constitution set up that the amendments are put down to legislation. You debate them in committee, you further debate them at final and report stage, and you either vote against them or reject them. And some will be accepted and some will be rejected out of hand, and some might have to be accepted in later years, found there was a real necessity. In fact, one of the ones in the finance bill yesterday was relating to the VAT increase from the hospitality sector from 9.5% to 13.5%. And what was requested by Deputy Mick Wallace was that this be reviewed after 6 months, which is totally reasonable. And this abortion legislation from passing has no review mechanism whatsoever, and I won't be. But to get back to the amendments, and his attitude at committee was appalling. And a kind of a cabal-like, agreement with every amendment that came from the pro-abortion side, every one of them that came, even though he couldn't accept many of them. They were excellent amendments, and they were great, and I see the reasoning behind them. And rubbished all our amendments and had total disdain for them, and tried to twist and turn that we were trying to do appalling things, which we weren't. Our amendments mainly were, first of all, around the conscientious objection. Most countries in the world, there's a conscientious objection. Even across the water in England, there's conscientious objection for every professional in the dealing in this area. Then about the humane, to give humane medication to a baby before it's killed, actually.
So
in the
pain
womb.
Relief, basically.
Pain relief, yeah. My goodness, I mean, pain relief every day of the week. There's videos then in the HSC telling people about how to take orally take medicines and different issues across a broad spectrum. Just because we had asked for a DVD to be available, not to be shown to a woman, but to be available of the kind of treatment, like you said, and the other treatments that may be available, you know, and supports as well. That was totally seized on. That we were trying to make a woman watch Gruley abortion. No such thing. I brought a 3-minute animated abortion to that so-called quango of abortion hearings we had there early in the year, and they refused steadfast to look at it. So, I mean, I think I was going to insist that a pregnant woman, before she has abortion, looked at this. Totally white of the mark. Media were disgraceful in the reporting of it. The next one was, my God, in any situation, goodness knows, we have terrible atrocities all over the world with wars and everything else in Yemen at the moment, and the thousands and tens of thousands of children starving to death. What we want, and I heard just this morning, a lot of them are dying because of the inoculations and the vaccines not being able to be given to these children, which are there with 15, 16, 170 years for all of us all over the world. So what we wanted was, if a child was born alive, and I have met women, who have survived the burst, are now in their 40s, once in Canada, once in the United States. If a child was born alive, an unsuccessful abortion, abortion that went wrong, and the baby survived, they wouldn't be left in a sluice, though. That if it would be given heat, basic things like warmth and maybe some resuscitation and some medical assistance, but it wouldn't be left callously there. You wouldn't do it with an animal, where you have a cat or a dog or whatever, you'd let them die if they were born, and let, you know, this wouldn't happen. Again, we were seized on over that. They were pretty humane, normal, and it'll be seen in the fullness of time, and when history is written about this particular debacle, they'll be seen for what they were, an effort by us to have humane treatment. The other one that was seized on by Deputy O'Connell and others, I made little of was, we wanted where surgical abortions were taking place, so late-term abortions, that the remains, the bodies, when we've had much talks about bringing back the remains in a box and a plane or whatever, we wanted a dignified burial for, you know, late-term abortions. Not for, as Kate O'Connor tried to say it, for menstruation cycles and everything else. Totally hijacked and emotional language and rubbishing us as if we were callous. We wanted this to be a dignified burial. Goodness knows we have enough to talk about the June babies now, what went on and what's happening and the cost. We don't want a repeat of that. We know that in some jurisdictions that body parts have been sold, been harvested and been sold, and for all kinds of reasons, research, and indeed in many cases for the making of women's makeup. It's disgusting. We wanted to prevent that and to ensure that a late-term abortion for a fully formed baby had a dignified disposal and had new. And we weren't going to prosecute the mother. We weren't going to prosecute. We wanted sanctions for the institutions that carry out this. And that the fines be put on them and the penalties, that they are duty-bound to ensure that, first of all, they have a proper discussion and debate with the parents and the mother and whoever supporting her, and that she understands, and that there's respect and dignified respect of the human remains, you know, of fully formed babies. The other aspect was about the ultrasounds. We didn't want to force any woman to watch an ultrasound. We wanted enough for her to be there. And this is a huge issue with GPs up and down the country. They don't have access to ultrasound. We wanted to have the heartbeat and you know, and the movements of baby to be available if a mother should wish to see them. If the mother didn't wish to see them. We know in most abortion clinics they turn them away from, they don't see them, that's fine. If the mother doesn't choose to hear them or feed them, that's fine, it's all free and but we weren't coercing anyone. But the dramatic and the draconian language and the attitude of the minister and his official, only at one most of the time, was appalling, and the sighs and the shrieks and the gasps when we were moving our amendments was disgusting and despicable. As I said, we had a long debate yesterday and the day before and the committee during the week at the finance bill. There were no sighs or gasps.
Matty, all of your amendments were shot down, and I think many of the ones that you've highlighted there, as I said, I think people listening, whatever their position it is, would think they're perfectly reasonable. So what happens next in terms of this legislation?
Just one comment on those, first of all. I mean, they were put down in good faith, and, you know, they should have been respectfully debated. Like, they are across a wide plethora of legislation. I mean, the finance bill, social welfare bill, all those bills. That's what normal business does. But this seems to be an effort by the media and by some of the so-called liberals that we're backwards people, we're ignorant and we don't know what goes on. And first of all, I have 8 children myself, and I was present for all their births, thankfully. I have 4 grandchildren, I'm expecting 2 more grandchildren. And, you know, I mean, why am I humane as the next person, and I don't have to pray boast about it? What happens next is now, the normal course is into the Dáil debate starts on Wednesday evening and Thursday, going to sit late into the night. And like in any other piece of legislation, many amendments that were discussed at committee stage are down for further debate because the committee is limited. There wasn't one pro-life TD on the select committee. We went there, but we had to wait till last to speak, and we're not members of the couldn't vote. They were all voted down unanimously, or with one abstention some of the times. Pain relief, you know, ultrasound, indeed the conscientious objection. So it's very shocking. So the full Dáil now, will, and the full day of publicity as well, will be able to now debate the amendments when we move them, myself and colleagues, to put them down and debate them, and we'll be calling votes on them, and the full Dáil will have the opportunity to vote. We don't expect the so-called free votes in Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, but that's as far as it goes. The so-called, the pressure that's on TV is appalling. We don't expect them to be carried, but we do expect to have it on the record that we moved them. We debated them sensitively. They were humane amendments and approved and for people looking in, watching. And you don't expect the media to give that treatment, but we expect inside media people on TV to know why we put them down again. I said, you didn't ask me why the amendments on the finance bill were resubmitted to the Dáil last 2 days of discussion, because it's a normal course of discussing legislation through different stages. That is there under the Constitution. So we will give every TD the opportunity to vote yes or no for these, as I said, very humane, very carefully thought out amendments. And one or two of them we have amended slightly because we were accused of the DVD and maybe language around it wasn't 100% from our point of view, even though we had got Lyles to help us. You know, we don't have the resources of the state, but nonetheless, clearly, people know our bona fides. We weren't trying to, you know...
Matty, thanks so much for that update, and we will be following the ongoing discussions closely. That's Independent TD for Tipperary, Matty McGrath, talking to us there about the ongoing discussions in relation to abortion legislation. Announced that from next year, extra maternity and paternity leave is going to be extended by 2 weeks. And the overall aim is that government will extend this to 7 weeks by 2021. So how will it work in practical reality? Is it mandatory? Is it going to be paid? Really, obviously, it's welcome news because I presume the overall aim is to try and make sure that mums and dads are able to be at home for longer with their children. And in my opinion, having gone through it once and I'll be going through it again, having just 6 months at home just isn't enough. But is there a little bit of kind of a conflicting information coming from the government and policy as well? Because on the one hand, they seem to incentivise trying to push parents back into work, especially mums at a very early stage before the year mark. But then on the other hand, they are announcing policy like this. And even indeed their own research, and so much research from around the world would say, you know what, if it's possible for a child to be at home for the first 3 years, even if it's just, you mightn't be able to do it all of the time, but some of the time that's actually better. Well, someone who's written extensively about this topic is freelance journalist Victoria White, and she joins me on the line. Victoria, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, we'll start off if you can just explain this extra maternity and paternity leave. What do you make of it and how's it going to work?
Well, it's weeks each. Seven weeks for a father and 7 weeks for a mother. That's what they're building up to. So this will be added on to the 2 weeks of paternity leave that we got this year, and 26 weeks maternity leave. So I would not be surprised if your head is spinning by now, because, you know, as I described it in the Examiner yesterday, basically kind of a mishmash of good intentions, social engineering and necessity, because, you know, I mean, I would have an issue with, for a start, we haven't even come up to a year's paid leave, which is the minimum that UNICEF suggests and the minimum which the government itself suggests. But the other thing is that we have there 9 weeks, which is specific to the father. And I mean, I would be against making any leave specific to either parent, because I think it's for parents themselves to work out what works best for them.
In terms of the practical side of it, because it's just presumably going to be the state benefit, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And I suppose a lot of families would find themselves in a situation where they mightn't be able to take it, because it's another 3 months with, you know, a salary sacrifice, essentially. So how are we going to kind of encourage companies and workplaces to actually pay proper leave to their employees?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I got when I took leave from work, I got, you know, 100% of my pay. And in fact, it worked out better because of for various tax reasons. But only half of employers pay the top up on top of the statutory leave. It has to be said that a large proportion of people are no worse off on statutory leave because their pay is so low. So, I mean, low pay is kind of underlying every discussion we have about a social issue in this country at the moment, I think. I mean, you know, the state would have to step up more. I don't think the state can actually enforce the payment of an entire salary on every single company for, you know, a period of a year. I don't think that's possible. You'd have to have the state stepping up with a heftier leave. A heftier payment. That's about the best you can do. And I don't think you can expect that the state can guarantee 100% of income of somebody who might be earning perhaps €1,000 a week.
I know, yeah, in some other countries it is the state that pays. I think it's like 80% of the salary in the Nordics.
Well, 100%. Yeah, 100% in many countries, you know.
I suppose this is all part of a wider discussion, Victoria, just about the amount of time that in my experience, and obviously it's anecdotal, but pretty much every mum that I talk to that ends up having to go back to work after, say, 6 months, the key word is having. If they could spend more time at home, they would. But there seems to be a huge emphasis in this country at the moment of only supporting institutionalised childcare. You know, the government incentives are towards that, and in fact those who stay at home might feel that they're punished, certainly from a tax perspective they are. Why is there so much focus just on supporting one type of childcare?
Because it's easy for the government to manage. So, like, I mean, this goes back a long time. In fact, it goes back till about 2000, where we had the first big childcare strategy, which was the Equal Opportunity Strategy, which actually was administered by the Department of Justice. So it had actually nothing to do with children at all, which is fairly shocking. It was an EU scheme. It was to get women into the workforce, full stop. So you basically only got the full whack of the cash if your child was in institutional care for the full week. You didn't even get anything if you wanted part-time care, which is what most people want and which is not damaging to young children either. I mean, that's now we've moved on from that, but that's how shocking. That lasted 5 years. I mean, we're here digging up the past for the things that we've done to children. So here we had a strategy which was funded to the tune of a huge amount, hundreds of thousands of euro, and which was about absolutely aimed at getting women into the workforce and was not based in any research into the effects on children at all.
What do we know? What research is out there just in terms of having children out, you know, away from their parents for? Is it, you know, a certain number of hours is okay or a certain age or what do we know?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of research and it's all mildly differing one from the other. Though, however, it isn't over, you know, I mean, it's fairly, at the same time, it's fairly consistent. So, you know, researchers would differ on whether you're looking at 2 years or 3 years, whereby it's absolutely imperative that you would have one consistent carer for a child. So the UK did an audit of all international research headed up by their primary professor for pediatrics or whatever. And what they said that really the child should be in a one-to-one situation for the first 2 years. And then a further report was headed up by Penelope Leach, which many people will know as a childcare guru. And that was, they said, 3 years, that the child must be 3 years in a one-to-one situation. Now, so like research-wise, the kids come out better under parental care. However, next in line comes out childminder, which obviously substitutes a parent. I mean, you know, like since prehistory, it has never necessarily been the mum or and almost never the dad, actually, in prehistory that cared for a child, but it was auntie, granny, whatever. That's fine, you know. It comes out fine because, I mean, at the end of the day, the child just needs an absolutely consistent one-to-one relationship because the child, if you can try to understand that a very young child doesn't know, it's a person, doesn't know who or what he or she is. So it's the mirror of the face of the consistent, loving carer that reassures that child that it's all right to be in this frightening world, having come out of the womb, in this world, of course, that in the past, had many dangers, you know, wild beasts, et cetera, et cetera. They still need that level of reassurance, and they need that mirror of another face in front of them that they can trust to actually work out who and what they are and how they should feel and how they should regulate their emotions. And that's the area of emotional well-being that tends to suffer if in centre-based care, because there are no rules guaranteeing consistency of care. That's not to say it doesn't exist in centre-based care, because I know it does. However, there are no rules saying you must have one carer per child. In fact, the rules are like 3, 6, and 8 children per child. But also the carer can be sent on to the toddler room. You know, I mean, I've spoken to childminders who have been horrified because they've made this incredible bond perhaps in the baby room. And the next thing, oh, hello, today you're going to the toddler room, you know? Like, I mean, this is cruelty. I mean, the children will grieve. And I mean, I of course, you know, in many cases this doesn't happen, but we cannot sit over. What worries me is we still have government policy which is funding care situations that can be damaging to some children. That's just not good enough.
In terms of just the number of hours, Victoria, I mean, I personally don't know any parent that drops their, that is in a situation where they feel they have no other choice to pay the bills, to pay the mortgage or whatever, even with the high cost of creche, that they feel they have to go back out to work when they mightn't necessarily, in fact, they would rather do anything else. They'd want to care for their child, but, you know, they're gone, dropping the child off at 7 or 8 and picking them up at 6 or 7. And I know certainly when I was looking around and ringing creches, and thank God my granny looks after my baby in the morning for me, but all the creches I rang were only providing full-time care, whereas before there was at least a part-time option. So there seems to be a move that's really just pushing towards having children in creches for kind of 30, 40 hours a week. Is there much on that?
That's potentially damaging to them. And I mean, I can say that with absolute certainty. I mean, clearly, I've read this research internationally, but for the first time this week, the government has actually put the best of international research into its own document. So it's first five, it's across government strategy for the under fives in Ireland, says in bold type that young babies and toddlers shouldn't be in centre-based care for more than 32 hours a week, and if they are, that it risks damaging them. So, I mean, like, I very much welcome that for the first time ever, this government, I won't blame just this government, but Irish governments since 2000, have actually admitted into their type this basic research. Now, 32 hours sounds like a lot, but anybody who's doing a full-time job and commuting will go over that. So, I mean, however, the government strategy again does something very good that I've been calling on for ages, which is that it is requiring childminders to register with TUSLA, whether or not they, you know, how many children they have, as long as the children aren't related to them. So what we're looking at here is that we're going to, please God, get a professionalised childminding service, because Irish parents tend to prefer it. They find it more flexible, more personal, more like what they could provide themselves. And the thing is that, I mean, there are, this is the best, this is, you know, the second best, and of course the best in many cases when parents can't, either can't or don't want to be the parent themselves. And so we don't have to have those effects on a child of their parent being absent if we substitute the parent with something like the parent. Another home, it doesn't have to be your home, another home, as long as it's home.
Victoria, very interesting just in terms of the research that you've talked about today. Thanks so much for joining us on the programme this morning. That's journalist there, Victoria White. If you want to read her article, by the way, it is up online on the Irish Examiner's website, irishexaminer.com. You can find it under Victoria White, and the headline states, "Finally admits that children under five do better at home." I think that you have to stand back and say, is there a problem when one of the best known universities in the world is condemning or stopping certain people from speaking on their campus because they have decided that they are not speaking on certain issues in a politically correct manner? What does this say about freedom of speech at the moment? Well, our next guest is a British journalist who regularly contributes to The Independent and The Spectator, as well as the online magazine called Spiked. And he wrote about this phenomenon last week because a prominent broadcaster and feminist, Dame Jenny Murray, pulled out at a speech at Oxford University when she was condemned for being transphobic. On the line to tell us a little bit more about this story, we have Benedict Spence. Good morning, Benedict. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, thank you.
Well, tell
you?
Us a little bit about Dame Jenny Murray and what she was meant to be doing at Oxford and what happened next.
So Dame Jenny Murray, for those who don't know, is something of a broadcasting institution in the UK. She hosts the daily show Woman's Hour on Radio 4. And she has a very long and proud track record of being a feminist, very outspoken, being a strong champion of women's rights. She was invited to give a talk at the University of Oxford on the subject of feminism, and specifically talking about women's voices in history, powerful women and how they're portrayed and what problems they've faced. She was protested against by the university's LGBTQ society and a number of female women's and trans campaign groups. And they asked the society in question, the History Society that had invited her, to condemn what she has said in the past, which stems around issues of whether or not trans women can ever really be women. As you said, she's now pulled out of the event. The university hasn't no platformed her, as often happens, but she has pulled out, obviously due to the pressure that was mounting and not wanting to cause too much of a controversy. And the funny thing is about this, I mean, it's for a start, it's not the first time Oxford has no platform people. Oxford actually has a very long and proud tradition of banning people from speaking. You go back as far as the Reformation, atheists, Catholics, Protestants, and of course, even women haven't been allowed to speak at Oxford at certain times because of their beliefs. It's now rather curious that we've come full circle in the debate over women's empowerment, that women are now considered equal members and equal partners in society with agency and a voice of their own. And as a result of that, they're now being silenced by other women for not having the correct opinion. And that's what I find very curious about all of this.
And I think most people would kind of scratch their head and ask then, Benedict, well, who decides what the correct opinion is? And I know on this issue, whenever there is online, certainly on Twitter, and whenever people try to kind of just ask some of these questions, there's a hashtag that says no debate. In other words, you can't even discuss this at all. But where is the driving force for this, I suppose, clamping down on free speech coming from?
Well, this is, I mean, it's an interesting sort of sideway into the culture wars. I mean, everybody's talking nowadays about the culture wars, the alt-right and the radical left, but this is a conflict that's going on within the radical left itself between two different branches of the feminist movement. And it's coming essentially from the trans movement itself, which is now taken to the mainstream. The argument behind it being that you shouldn't criticize or question trans people in terms of how or whether or not they're allowed to identify themselves, what they identify themselves as. If you question that, that is considered essentially an assault upon their person. because they are a marginalized group, because they are supposedly an oppressed group. In the great big pantheon of oppressed groups, they come below women and many other groups. So they are supposed to be given special protection. Ironically, that protection, as they're getting now from branches of government and any number of political parties and corporations, shows that they're not oppressed at all. In fact, per head, they're probably a lot more authoritative than they would like to admit. The fact that, nowadays it's incredibly easy for people to change their gender, that record numbers of people are being referred for gender dysphoria therapy and sometimes for hormone treatment, it shows that there is, on one side of the left, a real movement towards this. And whether or not that's acceptable is beside the point. The point is that those who disagree with it are being silenced. That's the key issue here.
And I suppose that people could also, Benedict, see an irony in this. I mean, as a woman, I'm sitting here saying I feel that my gender is stamped on every part of my biology and, every gene that I have in my body. And as far as I understand it, certainly some of the loudest voices in the trans movement are white men, for the most part, who say they identify as women. And in other areas of life, they would be seen as a very kind of privileged group. So, have we a situation now where you essentially have a group of men silencing women for just having an opinion?
I mean, that is essentially what it is. Whether or not a large part of the argument over transgenderism comes down to whether or not being female is biological or whether or not it's a social construct. But of course, when you look at that, you have to say, well, even if it is a social construct, it's based on hundreds of millennia of evolutionary biology, which has got us to this position in the first place. You can't undo that in a matter of decades just because you come up with a new theory that says that it's a social construct. It's not as if men got around the fire one day and said, we're going to come up with this fantastic new system, and it's not based on logic or evolution in any way, shape, or form. But now you have, as you say, biological males, because you can't change your chromosome. That's the key thing here. Biological males who do come from what is traditionally viewed from within the left as the most privileged group in society, relegating themselves. And whether or not it's because, that's how they feel or because they're mentally ill, there are two different sides of the debate. And that's the key thing. There are two different sides. But whatever side you land on, it is a group of privileged people making themselves less privileged or painting themselves as less privileged and then using that oppression or that narrative of oppression to silence people who criticize them or take issue with what they say. And it is being driven predominantly, bizarrely, from within a women's movement by biological men.
In terms of, and I know Dame Jenny Murray, she decided not to speak, but you mentioned no platforming, Benedict, where people have been basically not allowed to speak. In terms of this particular issue, has this happened before to other women?
I mean, it has happened before to other women. I think the most prominent ones are Jermaine Greer and Julie Bindel. And, I think most women, or most feminists, rather, would remember them as being pillars of the feminist movement. So the idea that they are now being no-platformed, sometimes not no-platformed, sometimes just being put under pressure not to attend, so they don't have to be no-platformed, but the idea that these women specifically are being called out for being transphobic, for being misogynistic, for not towing the party line, as it were, I think it is a bit of a weird situation for most observers who aren't fully involved in this cultural conflict to be looking at it from the outside in and going, wait a minute, these are the people who have championed the rights of women above all else to be able to be individuals, to have agency, and to speak their mind from the oppression of men. And now we're in a, it must seem like quite a perverse situation where people who were men, who were born men, and who, biologically speaking, still are men, are now allowed to just turn around and say, well, I feel like a woman, and you can't talk back to me about this.
What about other women, especially those, and I know, of course, there's many different strains to the feminist movement. I mean, for example, Benedict, here at the moment in Ireland, we're having a huge discussion on the gender pay gap and female-only professorships, and it's an ongoing discussion. In other words, the importance of having men and women in different aspects of life, be it political, business, or whatever, because presumably women can bring, we can complement one another, on the one hand. But on the other hand, when it comes to this issue, those very same feminists seem to not defend other women when they are being silenced.
Well, exactly. That's the great double standard in this. And I mean, my personal opinion is that it comes down to a need almost to have a cause, having fought the cause for women's equality. And although it is not what most of them would like it to be completed, I suppose. The trans issue is far more of a sort of an exciting fight to fight, this idea of this very marginalized group. And, you know, trans people do suffer a disproportionate amount of violence, of discrimination, of hatred. There's no question about that. But the fact that it is, as you say, it's coming at the expense of other women, and that it is other women driving this forward and not standing up for their own, you know, fellow feminists' right to just speak their mind. Once upon a time, this was the establishment that was doing this. This was upper-middle-class white men, the clergy, business, saying, no, no, you can't do this, you can't say this, know your place. Now it's women turning to other women and saying, know your place. I think that's just a rather perverse situation to be in.
And a lot of the time is, you know, whatever Dame Jenny Murray has said or Germaine Greer has said, is the biggest offence is that they just might hurt somebody's feelings?
The argument is that questioning whether or not trans women are real women threatens their existence. I can see, if you follow the logic, you can see where this leads to, that questioning whether or not they are real women sort of justifies more vociferous opposition to them identifying as women, which potentially means, if you were to follow that to its logical conclusion, that they would be physically prevented from living their lives as women. I can understand the fear of that logic, of that narrative, but actually it's not to say that that will necessarily happen. People should have the right to criticize, to raise their objections, to voice their opinions. It is then up to us as a society whether or not we decide to go down a certain path. Just because you decide to criticize the movement or critique it doesn't mean that you're going to start then preventing people from living a life how they want to. My personal view is that provided it doesn't hurt anybody, people should be allowed to live their lives however they choose. And if that means living as a trans man or woman, absolutely. They should be allowed to do that as long as it doesn't impact other people's rights. The key thing here is it is impacting other people's rights, their basic right to free expression. And that's an issue.
And indeed many other rights, but we don't have time to get into that today. But I know there's obviously ongoing discussion on legislation on that in the UK, but maybe that's a chat for another day. Benedict, thanks so much for joining us on Spirit Radio
Thank
this
you
morning.
So much.
That's journalist Benedict Spence, by the way. If you want to find out more about Benedict, and you can follow his articles and all that, he has got a website, benedictspence.co.uk, if you want to check some of that out. It does seem rather bizarre that sometimes what we're talking about is the hurt feelings of biological men are being used by some to justify the censorship of biological women.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.